caught in a hurricane. We use the engines hanging outside the gondola only to keep us from swinging too violently, otherwise we would have depleted our fuel in a matter of hours. We couldn't fight those winds. We could only surf along on them and try to keep the ride reasonably smooth. Truax, up in a safe, stable orbit, was supposed to keep track of our position by monitoring our telemeter beacon. This was for two reasons: to stay in constant communications contact with us, and to plot the direction and speed of the superrotation wind, with Hesperus playing the same role as a smoke particle in a wind tunnel. But Truax hadn't deployed the full set of communication satellites around the planet by the time we got caught in the superrotation. Without the commsats to relay our beacon, they would lose almost half our first day's data. And if anything had gone wrong, they wouldn't know about it for 10 hours or more. Fortunately, the only trouble we had was a few bruised shins, as Hesperus lurched and swirled in the turbulent winds. It was like being in a racing yacht during a storm. You had to hold on to something whenever you moved from one place to another. It was scary at first, I admit. No amount of lectures, videos, or even VR simulations can really prepare you for the genuine experience. But in a few hours I got accustomed to it, more or less. I spent most of those hours right there in the observation blister, staring out as we darted along the cloud tops. Marguerite got up and went back to her lab. Crew members passed by now and then, stumbling and staggering along the passageway, muttering curses every time the ship pitched and they banged against a bulkhead. At one point, Marguerite came back to the blister, a heavy-looking gray box of equipment in her hands.
"Shouldn't you be checking the sensors up forward?" she asked, a little testily, I thought.
"They're running fine," I said. "If there were any problems, I'd get a screech on my phone." I tapped the communicator in the chest pocket of my coveralls.
"Don't you want to see the data they're taking in?"
"Later on, when the ride settles down a little," I said. It had always nonplussed me that many scientists get so torqued up about their work that they have to watch their instruments while the observation is in progress, as if their being there can make any difference in what the instruments are recording. Marguerite left and I was alone again, watching the upper layer of the cloud deck reaching for us. Long, lazy tendrils of yellowish fog seemed to stretch out toward us, then evaporate before my eyes. The cloud tops were dynamic, bubbling like a boiling pot, heaving and breathing like a thing alive. "Don't be an anthropomorphic ass," I warned myself sternly. "Leave the metaphors to the poets and romantics like Marguerite. You're supposed to be a scientist." "Of sorts," a sardonic inner voice scoffed. "You're only playing at being a scientist. A real scientist would be watching his sensors and data readouts like a tiger stalking a deer." "And miss this view?" I answered myself. We were dipping into the clouds now, sinking down into them like a submarine sliding beneath the surface of the sea. Yellow-gray clouds slid past my view. Then we were in the clear again. Then more mountains of haze covered the port. Deeper and deeper we sank into the perpetual global sulfuric acid clouds of Venus. The ride did indeed smooth out, but only a little. Or maybe we all became accustomed to the pitching and rolling. We got our sea legs, our Venus legs. It was eerie, sailing in that all-enveloping fog. For days on end I stared out of the ports and saw nothing but a gray sameness. I wanted to push ahead, to go deeper, get beneath the clouds so we could begin searching the surface with telescopes for the wreckage of my brother's vessel. But the mission plan called for caution, and despite my eagerness I understood that the plan should be followed. We were in uncharted territory now, and we had to make certain that all of Hesperus's systems were performing as designed. The mammoth gas envelope above us had been filled, if that's the right word, with vacuum. Its hatches had been open to vacuum all the time of our flight from Earth orbit, then sealed tight when we entered Venus's atmosphere. What better flotation medium for a lighter-than-air vessel than nothingness? Now we were slowly filling the envelope with hydrogen gas sucked out of the cloud's abundant sulfuric acid through our equipment that separated out the wanted hydrogen and released the unwanted sulfur and oxygen. On Earth, hydrogen's flammability would have been dangerous, but Venus's atmosphere contained practically no free oxygen, so there was no danger of explosion or fire. The envelope itself was a rigid shell of Cermet, a ceramic metal composite that combined toughness and rigidity, yet was lighter than any possible metal alloy.
To go deeper, we would vent hydrogen overboard and replace it with atmospheric gas, mainly carbon dioxide. When the time came to rise again, we intended to break down the carbon dioxide into its component elements of carbon and oxygen, vent the carbon overboard, and let the lighter oxygen buoy us upward. Higher up, we intended to dissociate the sulfuric acid molecules of the clouds again and refill the envelope with hydrogen. We had tested the equipment for splitting the carbon dioxide and sulfuric acid molecules before we ever took off from Earth, and now, inside the globe-girdling cloud deck of Venus, we put it to work to fill the gas envelope with hydrogen. Eager as I was to go deeper, I was perfectly happy to see that the equipment worked in Venus's clouds. I had no desire to be stuck down at the surface with no way to come back up. So we coasted along in the uppermost cloud deck, patiently filling the big shell above us and testing our equipment. Once in a while it seemed to me like we weren't moving at all, that we were stuck in place like a ship run aground on a reef. All we could see out the ports was that perpetual yellowish-gray sameness. But then some strong current in the atmosphere would grab us, and the gondola would tilt and groan like a creaking old sailing ship, and my insides would flutter just a little bit. I was constantly worried about Fuchs, of course, but the IAA reports on his activity showed that he was also moving cautiously. He had entered the atmosphere several hours before we did, but so far had not gone much deeper than we had. Like us, he was floating in the upper reaches of the top cloud deck, pushed around the planet by the super-rotation winds. "He's no fool," Duchamp told me as we sat together in the Spartan little galley. It was the only place aboard Hesperus where two or three people could sit together other than the bridge. "Lars takes risks," Duchamp said, "but only when he's certain the odds are in his favor." "You know him?" I asked. She made a thin smile. "Oh, yes. Lars and I are old friends." "Friends?" I felt my brows hike up. Her smile faded. "I first met him just after he had lost his business and his wife. He was a pretty desperate man then, hurt and angry, bewildered. Everything he had built up in his life had been snatched away from him." She made a noise, something between a grunt and a sigh. The expression on her face told me she knew perfectly well that the man who had destroyed his company and taken his wife was my father. She didn't have to say it. We both knew. "But he pulled himself up again, didn't he?" I snapped. "He's done fairly well in asteroid mining, hasn't he?" Duchamp looked at me for a long, silent moment, the kind of look a university professor gives to an especially dense and hopeless student. "Yes," she said. "Hasn't he?" In the clouds. At least, during those first days coasting through the clouds, I had an excuse to stay close to Marguerite. I was supposed to be a planetary scientist, I kept reminding myself, and even though she was a biologist, we began to work together, sampling the clouds. Marguerite's lab was too crowded for both of us to use it at the same time, and it would have been impossible for us to work together in either her quarters or mine. Neither of us had anything more than a narrow berth with a screen shuttering it. We could have both fit in either berth, but no scientific research would have been done. Indeed, I found myself wondering what it would be like to have Marguerite cupped beside me in my berth. But she had no romantic interest in me, that was clear. Instead, we turned the observation post up in the gondola's nose into a makeshift laboratory, where we took samples of the cloud droplets and analyzed them.
"There really is water in the clouds," Marguerite exclaimed happily, after a long day of checking and rechecking the results of our spectral analyses.
30 parts per million, I grumbled. "It might as well be zero for all the good—"
"No, no, you don't understand," she said. "Water means life. Where water exists, life exists."
She was really excited. I was more or less playing at being a planetary scientist, but to Marguerite, the search for life was as thrilling and absorbing as Michelangelo's drive to create great works of art out of rough slabs of marble. We were sitting cross-legged on the metal decking up in the gondola's nose section because there was no room for chairs, and nobody had thought to bring any cushions aboard. The transparent quartzite nose itself showed only the featureless yellowish-gray of the eternal cloud deck. It might just have been spray-painted that color for all that we could see out there. Two mass spectrometers sat to one side